Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and with me is a Mata Hari of podcasting. Or is she? It's Lydia.
I could be a double agent. You never know.
Double or triple agent.
I'm a quadruple agent.
Hi, Lydia. Welcome back to the show.
Thank
Fantastic to talk to you, as always.
Yay.
Before we get any deep in here, I wanted to point out, our previous episode, we talked about The Bat, and we mentioned the 1926 film quite a lot. I just want to tell our listeners, in case they aren't subscribers to the YouTube channel, I did go and find a pretty decent copy of the 1926 silent film and posted that if you're curious to watch that. I think we both really recommended that they do. You could watch that instead of the actual film we talked about. And it's not on our channel, but I did watch The Bat Whispers from 1930. And that was really interesting, and I would recommend that one as well. It's almost a shot-for-shot remake of the silent film, but, of course, with dialogue. So it was really interesting and well worth a watch. I still think the silent might be my favorite of the three, but, definitely would recommend that people check all three of them out, I guess, really.
All right.
All right, well, thanks, everyone, for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever you choose to listen, if you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. That helps get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully into more ears. Another great way to help is just by sharing the show on whatever social media platform you use. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we've covered here on the show. And if you'd like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. Let's listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we will try our hand at espionage when we go inside the lines.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Kidnap Caper. I was shocked to learn that a wealthy industrialist named Quigley had been kidnapped. Mrs. Quigley asked me to investigate when she received a strange ransom note in her husband's handwriting. It said to have their son John bring $200,000 in small bills to a nearby park at 10 o'clock that night. But we don't have a son named John, Mrs. Quigley told me. Very interesting, I said. I believe Mr. Quigley's trying to tell us something. In a moment, I'll tell you what.
Hi, I'm Brad. This is Josh, and we are the host of the We'll Bring the Popcorn Entertainment Podcast.
Each and every week, we'll be bringing you the latest stories from the world of TV and film, as well as breakdowns of the TV shows that we're currently watching, and all of the films that are hitting theaters that we go and see as well.
You can find us on YouTube, along with all the popular podcasting platforms for our social media. Anything else you want to know about us, you can head over to WillBringThePopcorn.com.
We drop new episodes each and every Monday. We hope you'll take the time to check us out.
In the case of the Kidnap Caper, the note mentioned a son, John, who didn't exist. I had a hunch the letters J-O-H-N were a code corresponding to numbers, the phone number where Quigley was held. The hunch was right.
Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Inside the Lines is from 1930. It was directed by Roy Pomeroy from a screenplay by John Farrow and Ewart Adamson, which in turn was based on the 1915 Broadway play of the same name, written by Earl DeBiggers. That name sounds a little familiar. We mentioned him because he was the creator of the Charlie Chan character. This version is a remake of the 1918 silent version, all also of the same name. Jane Gershon and Eric Woodhouse are enjoying a whirlwind romance in Germany when Jane announces that she must leave for London, but cannot give any explanation as to why. Eric is heartbroken, but after news of Germany declaring war on Russia, he feels it may be best for Jane to be in a safer place. Unseen by Eric, Jane has received an encrypted message that instructs her to meet someone in Paris immediately. We learn that Jane is apparently a spy for the German army. She has been trained and instructed to infiltrate the British fortifications in Gibraltar and disable the British fleet stationed there. posing as Ellen Courtier, a childhood friend of the governor's wife, Jane easily settles in. However, things get complicated quickly when Eric, of all people, shows up as the new aide to the major. Now loyalties as well as emotions are tested as Jane tries to carry out her assignment, but all may not be as it seems. Betty Compson is our star here. She got her start, as with many, in vaudeville. While touring, she was discovered by producer Al Christie, and her first film under contract with him was Wanted, a Leading Lady, in 1915. In 1916 alone, she'd make over 20 short films and one feature-length film, Almost a Widow. For the next couple years, she would make primarily short films before finally moving on to feature films exclusively. After success in a 1919 feature, The Miracle Man, Paramount Pictures signed Compson to a 5-year contract. Her popularity and success allowed her to start her own production company as well. Her first movie as a producer was 1921's Prisoner of Love. When her contract with Paramount was due for renewal, the company refused to raise her salary from the $2,500 a week they were paying her. Not willing to re-sign without a raise, she signed with a picture company based in London, where she starred in 4 films, including a 1923 picture, Woman to Woman. Woman to Woman was a big success and was popular enough to convince Paramount to offer Compson top dollar to return. Though her time with Paramount was short, as they decided not to renew her contract, Compson went freelance and worked with some smaller studios like the fledgling Columbia Pictures and Chadwick Studios. She appeared in First National Pictures' Part Talkie, The Barker, in 1928, and garnered an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress for her role. She would lose to Mary Pickford in Coquette. Her resurging popularity brought her many parts in the talkie era of film. Unlike many of her silent film contemporaries, her voice recorded well, so much so that while not a singer, she was cast in many musicals. But with the singing voice dubbed. She starred in 9 films in 1930, including today's topic, but the only one that could be called a success was The Spoilers, where she starred alongside Gary Cooper. This would be her last successful outing, but she continued to work primarily in Poverty Row films until she retired from acting in 1948. We recently watched Ralph Forbes in 1926's Beau Jest, in which he played the middle Jest brother John, a role he would return to in 1931's The Beau Ideal, a critical and financial flop for RKO Pictures. I can find very little additional information about the man other than that he was born in Great Britain and began his career there before moving to the United States in the early 1920s. He entered Hollywood film in 1926 in Beau Jest and worked steadily until a few years before his death in 1951. Yeah, there's actually kind of not a lot of information about this film or a lot of the people in it that I could really uncover. Unless you found anything, and sometimes you do a little bit of research and you hit gold sometimes.
Not specifically. We're in kind of a weird place. I feel like we've seen Betty Compson in something else, but I couldn't tell. She was in The Lady Refuses, which sounded super familiar to me.
We have done The Lady Refuses, so we have seen her. She was not a starring role. I think she was just also, you know, a supporting actress.
And it was in 31, so I would have almost expected her to have been. She was top billed in the 1931 version. That may not have been what we covered, though, because I pulled it up and started looking at it, and it didn't seem very familiar to me.
Was that her? Oh my gosh, yeah, that was the one. Let's see, it was the woman, she's destitute kind of thing, and she gets paid by somebody to
like distract the son from the gold digger.
Right. Yes. Was that Betty Tom?
She's top billed in that.
Oh, okay.
With John Darrow and Gilbert Emery.
I misspoke then.
Yeah, for some reason, just the title stuck out at me. But then when I went and started kind of perusing through it, it didn't seem familiar to me. So it must not have been one that we rated very highly, because if it had been, we would have both remembered it, I think. As far as Ralph Forbes, he did a number of things that you'd recognize. He was in the 1939 Hound of the Baskervilles. He was in... I started to mix him up with the next person I'm going to mention. He was just in a whole bunch of different movies that you probably would recognize. He was in the 1936 Romeo and Juliet. Everybody knows what that is. The 13th Chair, which sounded familiar to me. The 1935 Three Musketeers, but is a minor role. And I think that's probably what we're going to run into with Ralph Forbes, is he was in either... played major roles in minor films or minor roles in more major films. The other interesting person in this, and I don't know if you were going to talk about Montague Love.
No, please do.
It was in like everything for a little while. he was in The Mask of Zorro, but as Don Vega. He was in Son of Monte Cristo, which we ended up watching. Me and my husband ended up watching just... for kicks, because he's a big fan of the Count of Monte Cristo, and so we watched that one. And then he's in Northwest Passage, which you've heard the title of. He was in The Seahawk, which is one of my favorite classic films that I remember watching as a kid. Gunga Din. Everybody knows Gunga Din, right? So he was in just so many. The Prisoner of Zenda, 1937. He played Detchard. Ah, and that's, unfortunately, that's the Ronald Coleman. Oh, no, wait, that's the good one. That is the good one with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. in it. He was in a whole lot of things, but usually not, of course, not as the main character. It's interesting to go in, and he's one of those characters that you go and you kind of look into him. He got third billing in this movie, and he probably was very well known in his time. We go back and see, you know, he was in almost 200 films, and a lot of them are now well known, or at least the titles are well known, but could you pick him out in the lineup? Maybe not.
Right. Just a very prolific character actor, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and usually the kind of serious, somber, he played kings and things like that in Dons. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. I believe in this one he's playing...
he's the governor of Gibraltar.
Yes.
The guy in charge of the base.
Yeah, and so it's right along those lines of, you know, being King Philip and all of those other roles. Prolific guy, but again, not somebody that you necessarily would know his face from something.
An actor I was hoping to be able to dig up some information on, because I had a feeling you would get you got a big kick out of him watching this film, was Reginald Sharland, who was Archie.
I definitely noticed him, but I didn't dig into him.
Well, there's nothing to dig into, unfortunately. I mm-hmm. can't find any real, other than that, he was an actor, he starred in films, and
that and here's one of them.
Yeah, this is one of them, unfortunately. Yeah.
I just, on a whim, checked out Ivan Simpson, and he's another one that he's been in so many things that you know. Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn. Captain Blood with Errol Flynn, 1935, David Copperfield. These are just the top billings, right? There's, of course, a whole bunch more, over 100 movies, 1943 version of Jane Eyre, but a minor character. So it's interesting. There are people in this that have been in major roles in major movies besides Betty Compson, of course, but you're probably not going to recognize them. But do go look through their list, and if you see something that looks like it was maybe a big film and you haven't seen it yet, go watch it.
Yeah, I was just looking at Evan Thomas, who played the Major, which is a fairly minor role in this film. But we saw him in The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yeah.
Apparently, he was somewhere in there.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's so fun about this era of Hollywood, is it feels a little bit like British television now, because if you watch anything on BBC and then go watch something else on BBC, you're going to recognize somebody. And I think probably at this era, it was a lot like that in Hollywood.
Yeah, he was also apparently in The Little Princess, and he was in a version of Hound of the Baskerville in 39. I think you mentioned just someone else being in that.
Yeah.
So,
well, gosh. And then I believe the guy that played, he played, I think, the Indian manservant, the character is Amadi. Mm-hmm. It's Misha Auer, and he was in My Man Godfrey, Destry Rides Again, which may just be something my dad loved, and so I recognize it. But interestingly, I think he actually was an overseas actor for quite a while, but he has a really, definitive, he has a face that you would really, I think, recognize, but I think they, made his skin darker for this role. They really wanted him to look Indian. As in from India. And so they, you know, of course, dressed him up like that. I thought he was dressed as a nun at first. I was like, oh, it's a man dressed like a nun.
And then, no, it wasn't. I'm not the only one. There was one moment where he shows up on screen and I thought he was pretending to be a woman.
You did too?
Yes.
Okay, good. That makes me feel a little better because I was like, oh, apparently I'm just, yeah, maybe it was just questionable costuming then.
I did know. I was like, are we introducing another character? Or then it turns out to be this guy. Like, well, yeah, why is he dressed like, oh, that's okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's his hat.
Well, I think the first time I saw him, I thought he was dressed like an Indian retainer, but then near the end of the movie, he comes in with a wimple, and that's the only way to describe it. I thought he was wearing a wimple anyway. But yeah, it's another, there are a lot of, like you said, character actors in this. So it's fun to dig through their credits, but you probably won't recognize their faces.
Oh, that's interesting. I was just, you'll have to excuse me. My week has been really busy, so I probably didn't do due diligence on doing some research. Wilhelm Van Bricken, who played our spy master, I think, that meets with our lead character.
And tells her what her mission is.
Exactly. He was an actual German diplomat and spy during World War I.
Wow.
And then he went on to become an American character actor of silent and talky films.
Like you do.
Exactly.
He must have been a good actor because he was a successful spy. He survived. So
right.
That's very interesting. That's super interesting.
Well, we'll talk about his acting, I think, when we can talk about his acting. And maybe it's because he was indeed, you know, a German native.
Mm.
He right off the bat, and since we see him fairly early in the film, mm-hmm. there are times where I feel like he is spitting out his lines phonetically.
You'd better take this. You never know when you may need it. You have all your instructions.
Yes, but are you sure there's no chance of the actual Miss Courtier appearing?
None whatever. We have taken good care of that.
And the passport?
Here. Also, her violin. I hope Miss Gershon still plays the violin as well as ever.
Certainly. And where's the luggage?
Her luggage is at your hotel. Of course, I don't have to tell you to be careful. Gibraltar's not exactly a pleasant spot for people in our line of endeavor.
I'll be careful.
I want to impress upon you that this is not only an unusually important mission, but an unusually dangerous one. Under no circumstances whatsoever must you reveal your identity, except by the innocent use of your number. Remember, you're acting absolutely alone, without assistance. In enemy country, your sex cannot save you. Male or female, you are a spy.
I understand perfectly.
There's no more to be said, except... Auf Wiedersehen, Fräulein.
Auf Wiedersehen, Herr Hoffmann. Ich bin genauso deutsch wie Sie.
As German as I. Perfect, my dear.
Let's actually back up even a little bit from there and talk about the very first scene where you have Jane and Eric profusely professing their love. They can't believe how happy they are. They've known each other just a week, but it's so special.
Mm-hmm.
And they almost lost me from this scene.
You're not going away because of someone else.
Oh, no. You mustn't think that. There's no one else. There couldn't be. Eric, will you say goodbye to me here?
Why here?
Because I want my last thought of you to be here in this garden, where we've been so happy together.
Last thought? You don't mean that this is really goodbye?
No, not goodbye. Just auf Wiedersehen.
She's so, oh, you're the most wonderful man I've ever met. I can't believe how happy. She's shouting her lines to the back of the audience. Yeah. And there's no audience. And you have to, you come to believe from later in, I came to believe from later in the movie that this is her pretending. But it's not supposed to be her pretending. It's supposed to be her being genuine about really being crazy about this guy that she's known for a week, like you do. I mean, who among us ladies has not met a guy and within 7 days decided he was the man for her for all of eternity? I'm sure that happens a lot to some people. But both of them, their interaction felt so staged that when then you find out that she is a spy working with this German informant, I thought, oh, okay. So she was just setting that guy up, or she was just playing with that guy. And then that's not the case.
Right.
It was very, let's say, questionable.
I feel like we're not burying the lead at all here, in that this is very over melodramatic. Mm-hmm. And this is a lot of, I think it suffers from the time in which this story is being told, you know, 1930. Mm-hmm. And we're probably maybe dealing with actors who aren't as familiar with sound films, a director that may not be as familiar with sound films.
Yeah.
And so everyone is doing their silent film
acting. Absolutely. That is, I think that clarifies it perfectly. Yeah. For me, from the beginning, I thought, what is this director doing? Well, at first I thought, what is this actress doing? And then I thought, no, when you see her interacting later, she's fine. She's good. And so then I thought, oh, this is just a very poor director. And then there's a scene near the end we'll talk about in a little bit, I'm sure, where I thought this director had no idea what he was doing. What in the world is this person thinking? But you saying this is probably a hangover almost from the silent era, from vaudeville for sure. If these are stage performers, they're performing like they would on stage, this makes way more sense than if, or if the director is just a very not great at what he's doing.
Well, I even noticed her makeup. It felt very much like the silent film. Her lipstick, her mouth was so emphasized.
Interesting.
It's as if we needed to actually be able to see that her mouth is moving. No, we can hear her. We know her mouth is moving.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is an element of makeup at this time was very different than what we do now, right? Very red lips were very much in. You know, so there is some of that is that some of it is, yeah, we're filming on black and white, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the classic tale of them using green lipstick because it showed up better on film than red did. And so there's a very good possibility she's wearing green. We just don't know it.
Checking, this particular director did not direct many films.
And we're not shocked by that fact. And again, we'll talk about it in a minute, probably why I specifically think that that makes a lot of sense.
I think this is only his second talking or his second sound film.
Yeah. It looks like, oh, go ahead.
And he only directed three films prior to this, I believe.
Looks to me like possibly short ones. I'm only seeing one before this and one after.
I'm showing a 1924 version of Peter Pan.
Oh, okay. I'm seeing that as, let's see, I'm not seeing that.
Oh, I'm seeing that,
that
as directed
credit.
As Herbert. Yeah,
I think that was a different credit.
Yeah, okay, my mistake.
We could just scrub all that in post.
Yes, I think we'll definitely have to do that.
Let's pretend we know what we're talking about. Yeah. I'm looking it up too. It looks like this is the second of three movies he filmed, and I think it is interesting the timing on these, because he directed one in 28 and then one in 30 and then one in 34. Those are quite widespread from one another. It's not like he came in and did a couple of projects and then they let him go. It was like he did one and then there was some time and then it's almost like, I almost wonder if he didn't fill in for somebody else.
Just looking at things like IMDb, he has a lot of credits for special effects and additional crew. So I'm just wondering if he was one of these everyman.
Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if he was filling in for somebody here.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that, and so there could be just a level of inexperience, mm-hmm. Certainly when it comes to sound films.
Yeah.
Because we've seen a handful of sound films from this very year that were not this over melodramatic. That the people weren't shouting to the back row.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a blanket statement for, oh, all movies in 1930 were like this.
Right. And I think it stands out because they weren't all like this. If every movie we had seen from 1930 was like this, we'd just be saying, oh, this is a 1930 movie. But they're not all like that. And even her performance, I feel, later in the show, I feel both of the main leads' performances are not poor at points. At points, you're kind of captivated, you're kind of interested in what's going on between them, but then there are moments where they are staring down the barrel of the camera and it feels like it almost feels like an experimental film. Like they're trying to get the audience really interested by doing something a little out of the usual, and it does not work.
The film in itself, I feel like, is a little odd in that the subject matter, even being that it's a period piece, it's a film in 1930, but it takes place at the start of World War I.
Ah.
You know, the film is made in between our world wars. You know, of course, they don't know that there's another war coming. But just the fact that it's odd to see a period piece, I suppose, this far back. Maybe that's just the, 2024 mind thinking, well, all these are period pieces to me because it's 1930 or whatever. But then to have them actually set it back another 10, 12 years.
Well, World War I didn't end very long before this. I was going to say 1920, but 1918. You're right. It's over a decade. So that is interesting. I wonder though, if some of this wasn't, I mean, there was definitely unrest going on in the world at this time. There were a number of other spy movies that were coming out around this era that, people were interested in. And you mentioned Mata Hari. there were stories that had come out of World War I that I think captivated the imagination of people. And so I'm not super surprised by the subject matter. I am surprised that they chose to make it German spies.
Yes. They actually made it seem like, you were going to be following, our heroes, if you want to call them that, were supposedly, Germans and working against, the British.
Yeah. And very early on, there is a twist in this movie. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that. Very early on, I figured out what it was. And maybe because, we're so accustomed to the good guys being who they are and the bad guys being who they are, But and it's, in my opinion, a clumsy twist as well. I don't feel like it was, intricately or well executed. It's very much feels like a hat trick.
It wasn't earned.
No, not earned at all. And so I don't want to rag on this movie too hard because it's almost too easy of a target. And it's a little, I feel like I'm jumping right to the end, but there are elements in this movie that are interesting. It's interesting that it's set in Gibraltar. I feel like that's You don't get that a lot, you know? It's interesting that the main character is a woman and she is a spy. Mm-hmm. And she's obviously the main character. There's not a question of, oh, is she the main character or is Eric the main character? No, she's the main character and she's the spy. You don't get that a whole lot. There are elements of this that are very interesting to me, but then they kind of turn it into like a tea room drama. They're like, oh, now I'm going to be in... and then she has to go and stay with a lady, somebody, and then she's going to flirt with people, and that's her power, right? They did, I think you mentioned Matahari. They were trying to kind of pull on that idea of female spies get their way just by their being alluring, but they did it clumsily because mm-hmm. then she's just hanging out in tea rooms with people, like having tea and playing the violin. And it's not exciting and it's not thrilling.
Yeah, we're told about her prowess as being a spy. You know, we're mm-hmm. told that Agent 1893, I think it was, was, you know, a ruthless and determined spy. But we don't see it. I really thought we'd see it at the very end.
Yeah.
With the very end when, you know, everything's been uncovered and, you know, it looks like she's going to have to kill this guy. I'm thinking, oh my God, are they actually going to have a woman, you know, shoot the spy?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it would have been phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
But what we end up instead is, again, a tea room drama.
Yeah.
Where, tears and you're like, wait, I think what they were trying for was, here's this super spy, or at least this reputed super spy, who then has her heart changed by love. But you, again, like you said a moment ago, it's not earned. Because when we meet the main characters, we're being told they fell in love over 7 days and everything is so wonderful with you, but I have to leave and I can't tell you why.
There's more to the story that you want, you actually kind of need. You can't tell me that these people fell in love in a week. You can't open your movie with that. I need to see these people meet. I need to know mm-hmm. what the hell they're doing in Germany in yeah. the first place.
Or I have to see something besides her just saying, I love you, but I'm leaving.
Yes. And maybe that's this film's biggest problem, is that it doesn't follow the show, don't tell. It just constantly mm-hmm. tells you all yeah. these things.
From a product study, this is a great movie to watch and then go, don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And in reference to that, there's a scene near the end where the two characters are having this. And actually, I think there's a little bit of confusing dialogue in it. It doesn't really clearly outline what the stakes are. But you do get the idea that they are both like trying to keep one another from getting killed
mm-hmm.
over this, you know, over this mission. And instead of having these two people that are supposedly madly in love with each other, clinging to each other, saying, no, I care about you, I care about you, you have them standing across the room from one another, one person in a shot staring down the barrel of the camera saying,
come here, dear. Look, you couldn't send those sleeping men to their death. Trapped like rats. Mangled. Tortured. Drowned. The man who loved me couldn't do that.
Now you're talking like the woman I loved. Not like the ruthless 1893. But why? Why are you pleading for these men?
I'm not pleading for them, but for you.
Why?
Because I love you. I love you more than my duty, more than my life. And there's only one end for the man who does this thing. Death, with his back against the wall.
Why, Jane?
And it's so wooden. And it's so awkward, everything about it. And even the editing, there are like little moments of hesitation or silence in between showing the two people delivering their lines. And so it feels like middle school, I'm trying to say forensics, but that's not right.
You keep waiting to hear from just off camera. Line.
yes. And it feels like a screen test. That's what it feels like. It feels like a screen test. Like they got these people in here and they're like, oh, deliver this line, but do it with a lot of passion and look right at the camera. And they did it. And you're like, and then it feels like they just took the screen test and just slapped them into the movie. And we're like, yeah, that looks good. This is where I keep going back to this director is, that's the scene that for me convinces me the director does not know what he's doing. Because you have a big set. It's very clearly a big set. You have two actors that are reasonably good actors. And instead of having any kind of connection between them, they're completely isolated from one another, physically and spatially. And then timing too, and it just is it's a train wreck.
I feel like when some of the revelations come along and we see our stars react to them, they're reacting the same way that perhaps someone who was like really into the book or something was reading and went, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's great. I'm glad you were that interested in the script and everything. That may be not how your actors should react to that.
Right.
To
those revelations. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels maybe amateurish is just the blanket term that I guess you could use.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You mentioned the director, and I happened to notice, and I have no idea anything about this director. I don't think there's a photo available of him on his biography or anything like that. But I happened to notice that he was born in India, and it makes me wonder if this is a cultural thing. Like as an example, and I'm going to use a modern example. I was watching a Korean drama, a modern Korean drama, and in the romantic modern Korean dramas, when the two main characters kiss, it is like freeze frame. It's not freeze frame, but you would think it's freeze frame because they lean into each other and their mouths touch and then they just stop and nothing else happens. And so we now, my husband and I now have a joke about Asian kissing. And so, oh, Asian kiss. And that means that you just touch your mouths together, but you don't move at all. And it's a cultural thing, right? It's how they show that culturally. And then also, you know, what's acceptable as PDA and in different societies and things like that. And I wondered a little bit if some of this wasn't mistranslation. And I suppose, again, I could just be making an argument I'm losing my vocabulary here. I could be saying the same thing you said about this being just a carryover from a silent film issue, where in silent films, this was acceptable, mm-hmm. right? But it wasn't good, though. Even in a silent film, this isn't good. In a silent film, having one person standing, you know, two people standing across the room from each other, looking down the barrel of the camera, moving their mouths, is not good. It never is. So I wonder if there's got to be something else going on here that we're probably never going to find out. Because this director was born in the 1800s and obviously is no longer with us. And the people that were part of this production are not around anymore. But yeah, I almost feel like one of the greatest values of this movie is to show it to film students and say, this is how not to make a movie. Don't do this. Like, don't take a relatively interesting storyline and then have all the interactions happen in somebody's, you know, sitting room. Everything that happens in a garden or a sitting room.
And it could be a combination of both. It really could. It's just, but you're right. We'll never know the true answer on this. This isn't even going to be one of those films that you're ever going to find anyone doing like dissertations on or something, or no. Trying to, you know, figure out the inner meanings of the of things. It's just
no. It's very it is what you see. There's a huge disappointment. There's one still on IMDb, and it has Jane dressed in her her dressing gown, which has these phenomenal big furry ploofs on the sleeves. It looks like something from Singing in the Rain, right? It's so great. And she has a, I want to say it's like a German Ruger. I don't know. It's a, she has a very World War I pistol pointed at another character. And the look on her face and her stance is so badass. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, this is the spy we're told she is that never shows up in the film.
I think that's the scene where I thought, oh my gosh, this is where the film's going to like save it for me. Because mm-hmm. I thought she was going to pull the trigger in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, the threat is eliminated for her by... Yeah. You know, it's kind of Chekhov's electrified safe.
I think that ultimately this movie promises a lot that it doesn't deliver.
Right. Yeah. I was very interested just by the premise alone. Like we were saying earlier, you know, it's a female spy. You know, like, okay, yeah. That's interesting. And then, you know, they build her up at the beginning and her German, spy master or whatever, he's telling her like, look, you're going in at this alone and this is very dangerous and your sex won't save you when mm-hmm. if they find out the truth, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female,
yeah,
you're a spy.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay, so you're raising the stakes. I'm like, you feel like the stakes are pretty high on this, even though she doesn't seem to act like it is. She's like, yes. Oh, I feel like I'm her. Oh, I think I've memorized it. I'm really good.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I feel like maybe I'm misremembering her. Maybe I'm confusing her with somebody else, but I feel like she's better than this. The character that they're selling us, I just thought of this. The character they're selling us is Helen Mirren in Red.
Yes.
And that is not what we get at all. Which, if they had made her that, this could be a really good movie. Right. But the other pitfall of this movie is I keep then comparing it with Alfred Hitchcock's British productions.
Mm-hmm.
The 39 Steps and Secret Agent, and there are The Lady Vanishes. There's so many out there really good spy movies from in this era. And this just, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, and this one's not that. Yeah, it's extremely uneven. You know, the story and the premise tells you it's going to be one thing. The people in the film act like it's something else, like it's mm-hmm. a lighthearted romp.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just leaves you somewhere in the middle and going, what is this?
This movie is a little earlier than the ones I just mentioned by about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But not enough to justify the gap, I think.
No, it's unfortunate because I think it's another one of these cases where I think the talent on screen could do better.
Mm-hmm.
I want to just throw it solely on the feet of the director on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. it was a stage play that someone said, wow, this would make a great film. And yes. then someone said, hey, this was a great silent. It'd make a great sound film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the third iteration of this story. So obviously someone thinks there's something to this. And I think there is. I think this story could be better told maybe later, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe five, like you were saying, like 5 years from 1930,
or maybe,
1935,
maybe just with a different director.
Or today. Yeah. You could make this film today.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think you could make it something pretty special.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, side note, total, just not, no bearing on any of this, but it is funny. Betty Compson was in a Hitchcock movie. She was in Mr. and Mrs. Smith in 1941.
Oh, nice.
So it might be interesting. And it looks like she's a very small part, but it might be interesting to go and watch that and see what Hitchcock made of Betty Compson.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a stronger director would have had a better shot at coming up with something, you know, quite a bit better than what we end up with this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just disappointing. Yeah. And I just, maybe it was just our expectations going in because of the premise, you know.
Well, yeah, we definitely were set up to be disappointed. And then also, I think, again, I do genuinely think that there are glimmers of Betty Compson in this, and in glimmers of, Ralph. Of Ralph
Forbes.
Of Eric. Thank you. I think there are glimmers of them being decent actors. And I think, I wonder too, if there's not a little bit of poor chemistry between them. Because even though, like, you know, I'm all gung-ho for the romance, I always want, you know, the good guys to win and the people to fall in love and live happily ever after. Don't remember at any point in this movie feeling like, oh yes, they finally found each other again, you know, or oh yes, it all felt very hurried.
Yes.
Very rushed.
I honestly almost was kind of rooting for her and Archie.
I feel just like a prisoner, and you're my guard taking me to my cell.
Yes. Isn't it jolly?
Why?
Well, I've never had you to myself for 5 minutes yet. Some bounder always comes barging in. Now that you're in my official charge, I've got you alone at last.
But only from here to my room.
Oh, that's all right. He certainly ordered me to take you to your room. But he didn't say how long I was to take. Taking you.
Oh, I see.
Well, I mean, we might sort of dilly-dally on the way.
We might what?
Dilly-dally. Loiter. Rally round, huh? You know, I know a lovely place. Here. We might listen to the nightingales sing.
Are the nightingales on Gibraltar?
No. But there are monkeys. Don't you remember? Why, Gibraltar's overrun with monkeys.
I remember reading something about it.
Oh,
no. Oh, look. We can watch the fleet, too.
Yes. Rather pretty, isn't it?
It's more than pretty. It's beautiful. It's hard to think of them being fighting machines. They look so peaceful now. Somehow their blinking lights remind me of fireflies dancing.
Yes. I like watching the blinking lights, too. Let's sit down.
I'd love to see them when they spring to life, when they sail out to sea in formation. It must be beautiful. I'd like to stay up all night and wait until I sail.
Topping idea. I'll stay up all night with you. Yes. They sail tomorrow at dawn.
At dawn?
Yes. 6 o'clock. The dawn round here is frightfully early. Yes. Do you know what makes tonight especially beautiful for me?
No.
You.
No.
Yes.
I feel very much honored that I should be so important in the life of Lieutenant the Honorable Archibald Plantagenet Chumley.
Oh, Miss Courtier. Alice. I mean Helen. Ellen. Please don't rag me. You know, I'm dreadfully sincere. Yes. You know, ever since you arrived here, I've been walking about in a daze.
I mean, honestly, I would have rooted for her. She had gotten out unscathed and burnt the whole place down. I probably would have liked this movie because it would have been different. It would have been a surprise. It would have been, you know, I may use the phrase, a strong female character. It would have been all of those things. But, you know, since it wasn't, it's just meh.
Meh. It was meh. And then I've brought him up like 3 times now. Archie. the comedy bit in this film. Oh, let's build up this idea that this is going to be a tense spy drama. And then rather, oh my. are introduced to Archie.
I could have seen this go as, you know, turn into a something slapstick. It's not the right era for it. In the 1930s, I don't think they could do spy comedies yet. But Archie could have been a really good foil for that.
But he was he definitely had his eyes set on our lead actress here. And honestly, they had more chemistry than her character and Eric did.
She was at least like trying to be flirty with him. I think that's part of it, is there's like a hard switch. Whenever she's interacting with Eric, she's just Mrs. Tears, you know? And then when she's acting with anybody else, she's being kind of flirtatious and interesting. And then Eric shows up and she's just like, ah, I'm a woman, I'm crying. And
is that an issue with the story? Because we never see them at their happiest moments. When we meet them, she's sad and distraught because she has to say goodbye.
I hear what you're saying, and I absolutely disagree, because that's the job of the director, right? To get those emotions out of the actor. Now, I mean, we look at it a little bit differently. This is obviously modern perspective, me saying this, but that would have been the director's job to say, hey, Betty, it feels a little stiff here. I'm not really buying that you're struggling or you know, fighting against your feelings for this person. Like, you definitely get, when he shows up again, she has that moment of worry where she thinks, oh no, is he going to tell everybody who I am? You get, that's where, I think those are the glimmers right in there, where he shows up and is like, oh, wait a minute, why is she here? And she goes, oh no, he knows who I am. But then all of that just kind of flops away again, and you're back to her being stiff or weepy, as opposed to it literally anything else. She could have been literally anything else. She could have been angry. She could have been threatening. She could have been frightened. She could have been, I mean, anything with him. And instead she's just, catch me, I'm swooning. And she, I don't think she actually swoons in this movie, but that's the mental state I keep getting from her.
Right. So I guess we could jump to ratings, and I get the feeling that no one's going to be too surprised on this one.
Five. No.
And no one was probably surprised at Lydia's joke at giving this a five.
Yeah. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I will go ahead. I think I came into this thinking I would give it as much as a two. And now, honestly, after talking about it, I'm struggling to give it that high. We have seen so much better films from this era. I'm looking at just a short list. And I mean, we had our issues with the Silver Horde, but we were taken with Evelyn Brent. We watched her in Framed also the same year, which we really enjoyed Framed. We even enjoyed Danger Lights more. Those are three films that we covered in 1930. Or from 1930, excuse me. That we liked more and didn't feel this stage production-y or this, you got to forgive it because it's so early, you know, in the sound era. You know, we didn't have any of those issues with these films, with these three films that I mentioned. So I find it hard to like let this film use that as an excuse for its poor quality. So maybe a two, but begrudgingly.
So I just, as you were working through that verbally, I just had a thought. The writer from this, the creator of this, Earl Derbiggers, is known for Charlie Chan. And Charlie Chan is a lot of puns, a lot of kind of silly interactions, a little bit of slapstick, some over-the-top drama, but intentionally. And I almost wonder, if we were watching this as a Charlie Chan movie, would we rate it higher? Because I feel like maybe there is more error in this script than I was giving it credit for. But you can kind of mold that into something like a Charlie Chan movie, and it's a genre. Whereas in this movie, it's not a genre, it's a flop. It's a problem, right? So I feel like if we met, if you dropped Charlie Chan into the middle of this movie makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a three. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, you know, it's not the best movie in the world. It's Charlie Chan, though. It's kind of fun. There was this cute little interaction where, you know, the one guy was trying to pick up on the spy woman, but he didn't really get to... Like, I feel like if you make this a Charlie Chan movie, it's pretty digestible. But it's not. It's not a Charlie Chan movie. But I looking at it from that perspective, it makes so much more sense to me as a movie. This is the Charlie Chan writer. He's missing his main character. So he's trying to write a character that he's not naturally good at writing. Maybe that's not what happened here. But in that context, the problems I have with this movie make a lot more sense. And even in that context, I'm with you. I don't think I can rate. I want to give it a two because giving it a one is like saying don't waste your time. I think there are probably there are definitely actors in this that you should see in other movies, 100%. But should you take the time to watch this movie? Should you spend 112 minutes? Don't spend 112 minutes of your life. Maybe an hour and 12 minutes of your life. You know, dedicating it to this movie. And I think no, unless you're looking for inspiration for your next big World War I spy novel. And this is not even going to be like good inspiration for it. I really, really, really want to say the costuming was not even good. That the costuming wasn't 1918 or 1917 costuming. I feel like it was 1930 costuming. So I think a one is fair. I think saying, you know what, they finished the film. They did make a movie. It did have a beginning, a middle, and the end. Well, it didn't really have a beginning because we came into the middle of this romance as they're leaving it, which is an interesting place to start a story. Let's start at the end of the romance. I want to not give it a one because I feel like one is just saying, why did they even bother? But then when I think about this movie, I feel like, why did they even bother? There's a lot that feels dialed in or inexperienced. And so unless you're a Betty Compson completionist, or Montague Love completionist, I don't think it's worth watching this movie.
No.
We mentioned already three or four other spy type films that are from near this era and are excellent.
Yeah, I just recently watched The Lady Vanishes. On a whim. I think it just came up on like Prime or something. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you might like this. I'm like, Hitchcock, yeah, sure, why not? Yeah. I'll give that a watch. It was a fun film.
Yeah. Did you know they remade it?
No, I'm not sure I did.
Yeah, the remake stinks.
I'm not surprised.
They remade it, I think, within the last decade. They're doing a lot of these, right? They're remaking a lot of the Poirot stuff. And love Kenneth Branagh. Huge respect for him. He is not Poirot.
Yeah.
He's just not.
And see, this falls into my... Don't go and remake films that were popular and enjoyed back in the day.
And perfect. And why would you remake Death on the Nile?
Right.
You do not need to remake Murder on the Orient Express. It is perfect.
But if you want to remake Inside the Lines...
Great idea. Yes. You know, you're making the speech that was made at the Oscars this past year saying, stop putting $500 million into a movie. Stop remaking all of these movies that are already... You don't go out and you don't cover a Michael Jackson song. Although there are people that do, and it's a waste of time. If you're going to remake something, take something that was mediocre and make it really good. Don't take something that was already, holy crap, the lineup in Murder on the Orient Express. Go look at the cast and just wipe the drool up off of your desk after you do, because it is phenomenal. It's an outstanding cast. And then they took it and they tried to make it again, and they did the same. Oh my gosh, I'm about to rant. They did the same thing with Into the Woods. They did the same. You're right. This is a great candidate. Hollywood, Inside the Lines, great candidate for a remake.
Absolutely.
Make it
again, make it better. There are so many great little elements sprinkled throughout this film that mm-hmm. would make a really good movie.
Yeah.
But it's not in this film.
No. Make a gritty Charlie Chan. Yeah. We've had a gritty Batman. We've had a gritty Superman. Make a gritty Charlie Chan. You know, go back a little ways. If you are desperate to remake something because you don't want to pay somebody for a new script, so you're going to go find AI for it anyway, go find something old that was mediocre and redo it. Don't remake My Man Godfrey. Don't do that. There's no point. I am full on ranting. I don't think I've gotten this heated up ever about anything.
And this is the time to do a film like Inside the Lines, where you've got your lead character is a female spy.
Yes. You know,
apparently working for German intelligence, for the enemy intelligence and everything. Like, come on. This is gold.
Make a movie about Helen Mirren's character in Red when she was young.
Right.
And make it period specific. Do one of those. Do The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but an original story, right? Do something like Inside the Lines. There's so much material, and we talk about so much of it on this podcast, that it is, gosh, it's all in the public domain. And a lot of it stinks, but there's a kernel of good in there. There's a story concept that you can take and hand it to somebody and say, make this interesting. Modernize this. Make it good. Or don't modernize it. Do another classic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, yeah. All right, I'm gonna stop my rant there. I'm gonna just take my little soapbox and set it aside.
Yeah, we'll both rant a little bit at the idea of stop remaking good films, because what the hell is the point?
Yeah, in any media, right? No surprise, I'm a big Jane Austen fan. Like, I don't have any problem with people taking Austen and reforming it. Gosh, Clueless was a masterpiece. Not a lot of people understand that it was a remake of Emma mm-hmm. by Jane Austen. I suppose maybe a lot of people do understand that. I'm fine with that. But don't just remake it and remake it and remake it and add naked butts because it's now we have to add a naked person into Pride and Prejudice to make it. Yes. Stop. It's good enough now. It's better than you can make it by continuing to just beat the hell out of it. So take something and do something different.
I may still be okay with you adding zombies.
if they had made it, let's talk about this, guys. Specifically not using Pride and Prejudice and zombies as an example. But let's talk about Pride and Prejudice and zombies. It's not Pride and Prejudice and zombies. The movie is Ninjas and Zombies. It's set in a faux Regency knockoff era. It's alternate reality, right? Sure, got it. It's alternate reality. Write a real story about zombies in the Regency era. I would love to see that. I would love to see a steampunk zombie movie, mm-hmm. like a good one, right? I won't even get on my soapbox about the book, which I genuinely believe could have been a good book, but it was... I will stop right there. I'm not going to step on anybody's toes. Some of these stories are so interesting, but then they just don't put the effort into making it intricate and detailed enough to be captivating. To be fair, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, they're a gimmick and they're funny. It's interesting. They're not meant to be original stories. They're not meant to be stories about the Regency with zombies. They're taking a popular work and shoving the word zombies in periodically, and it's a funny idea. It's a spoof. That's fine. But take that and make it a real story. All right. I said I was going to get off my soapbox, but then I got baited.
Okay, sorry, that was right my fault. I'm pulling the soapbox away from you.
That's all right. Now I've shared my opinion about stuff that I try really hard not to share my opinion about on this specific venue. But thanks for sticking with us if you have this far. Also, if you strongly disagree with anything that I just said, send us an email. I'd love to hear your opinion.
Absolutely. It does not have to be just on the film that we've covered, anything that we bring up in our discussion, because I know sometimes we go down some rabbit holes here and there, and we go on some tangents. And yeah, any comments anybody has, send us an email, orphanedentertainment@gmail.com.
Yeah, we'd love hearing from you guys. And I know we talk a lot about, hey, send us a recommendation, but if we say something even off the cuff, totally off subject, and it sparks the thought or interest, then we'd love to hear back from you.
Very much. But I think we'll put this one to bed before we go on any more tangents or rants. So that'll do it for Inside the Lines from 1930. Oh, if you're really, really bored, give it a watch. Certainly,
Watched it, I'm not going to apologize. It was fun to get to see a movie I never saw before.
No, absolutely.
But I'm not going
like
to recommend
it. It's interesting at the what they tried to do. I think that in itself is interesting, but it didn't all come together, and you know it's. It's putting a lot of things into a pot and thinking you're going to get a really good stew. And, you know, sometimes things don't always mix. Too much oil, too much water.
Yeah, they left the salt out. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, that'll do it for this episode. We'll be back in a month with another discussion. Until then, thanks very much for listening, everybody. Bye.
Bye. And happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, this is our Thanksgiving episode, isn't it? Well, I didn't mention any of that. Oh, well.
And instead I rant. Oh. Well, happy Thanksgiving. Here's your rant. Would you like seconds?